Hey, thanks for listening to Suicide Buddies. This is a podcast where we talk a lot about suicide, suicidal thoughts, and depression, and joke around about those things because we're comedians who have dealt with those things. So we like to have fun talking about it, and we hope that helps you. But we're not joking around because we take those things lightly. We just want to establish that right up top. So if you're dealing with suicidal thoughts right now, and especially if you're feeling yourself close to suicide, first of all, know there is no part of us that ever encourages it. Please stay safe. And if you are feeling that, we want you to reach out right now and call the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. They're so helpful. They will talk to you whenever, wherever. They really are just a great ear when you need someone to talk to. So please call if you need it. And otherwise, enjoy the show.
You know just what to do when I look at you, and I don't wanna go. They call me on the phone and won't leave me alone when I don't wanna go.
Just here we go.
Shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, tits, fart, turd, and twat.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Is that George Carlin's band?
Yeah.
Who was that? That was great.
Oh, you know what that was, Hampton. Don't fuck with me.
Blink 180 Jew.
That was...
The Zionist punk band.
I think that was spot on. Yeah. A shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, motherfucker, tits, fart, turd, and twat.
Kill Palestine. yeah, Blink 182 had that dumb song.
Family Reunion, yeah.
It was good at the time.
I was such a huge Blink 182 fan that I found out about that song and that it was only a radio single. They literally... printed it as a radio only. I think to send to radio stations, be like, ha ha, you can't even play this. Yeah,
we're running down the streets naked. Yeah. We're so fucking crazy.
We ask 14-year-olds to show their boobs. we're awesome.
Man, George Carlin's my favorite punk rock.
Man, yeah,
so
dude.
Cool.
I don't know, man. When I found out that George Carlin stole the 7 Dirty Words bit from Blink 182. is when I really stopped liking his stand-up.
I hate comedy theft. That's my least favorite form of art.
Honestly, I think they wrote it independently of each other.
If you've ever said a joke that you didn't write yourself, you're a fucking coward.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope you die.
Yeah, you're a coward and you're a fucking... You're a turncoat. You're a Benedict Arnold. You turned your back on comedy. You spat in the face of... what's his name? The fucking guy who created it. Lenny Bruce.
Oh, there it is. I thought you were going to say Marvelous Miss Maisel. I think she created comedy.
Yeah, I agree.
But she
stole creating comedy from Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
Personally, I think Moms Mabley started it all.
Who was the first funny person?
That was just a bunch of references. If you don't know those references, you don't know what the fuck we're talking about right now.
All right, I got a way to get it back on board. Okay.
I went to the doctor. Mm-hmm. He told me I had big balls. I'm scared, Dave. I got big balls.
There is so much of entertainment for years and years and years that was just them saying dirty words. That's all.
Yeah,
they were like, can you believe
rock,
this?
Dude.
Yeah.
I got a penis. It's a phallus. There's an end at the... And I got no malice.
Yeah. Malice Phallus by AC/DC is my favorite song.
And the fact that no band ever dared to conquer the pee hole
as a reference.
They talk about the balls. They talk about the shaft. They talk about their veins. No one's going, I got a pee hole. There's a little hole where the piss comes out.
And no one talks about the O-ring. It's like,
wait, what's the O-ring?
The O-ring is like the muscle around your butthole, dude. And it can fucking
I don't have any
snap.
Muscles around my butthole.
Not anymore.
Is it because I'm weak? Is it because I'm a wimp?
Yeah, dude, it's because you're a coward.
I can't believe I haven't been working out my ass muscles.
Anyway, I was such a big Blink-182 fan that I ordered a copy of Family Reunion off eBay.
Whoa,
and I still
that
have
takes
it.
Me back.
Yeah.
eBay is not around anymore.
Yeah, man. More like the past bay. Right?
No.
No, okay. No.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it. I was always scared of Blink-182 at the time.
Scared?
Yeah, it just I was like, oh, they got a porn star on the cover, and it seems really...
That's not Catholic.
It's really dirty. Yeah, it wasn't Catholic.
Yeah, it's not good Christian fun.
I don't know
fun.
What my values were at the time.
That's
at
very
all.
Odd. You're a weird guy.
My values have always been very all over.
Especially
the place.
In the song, two of the dirty words they sing are fart and turd. It's like, wait, who ever couldn't say fart?
The president? Up until recently, Dave. That's I mean, true. Finally we have That's a true. President who has the balls to yeah. say fart and turd and call his opponents farts and turds. Finally, we have a president with big balls. I feel like everything Trump says is AC/DC lyrics at the time. We're gonna lock him up with the big balls. Send him overseas with the balls.
Oh my God.
I hope Trump goes even further, dude. I hope he not only deports them, then he puts them in cages. So they have to be in cages in their own country. That's the kind of conservatism I'm into.
Wow. Oh my God.
This is Suicide Buddies, guys.
Donald Trump is Bon Scott. More like Bonald Trump.
You got it.
Yeah.
You're back into shape.
Yeah, man. I'm pretty good at stand-up.
Dave's getting into the groove.
Welcome to Suicide Buddies, everybody. You're listening to it.
Everybody's.
Everybody's.
All right, Dave. Here we go. Favorite fast food item. I'll go first. Taco Bell, steak taco.
I love that you pointed at me and said, all right, Dave. As if you're going to answer and then you answered. I would just want to see a 60 minutes interview.
I got Dave in the situation room. I got Dave in the hot chair. Here we go.
Okay, why? Talking to a Catholic priest. Why did you molest those teenagers? I'll go first.
I'll go first.
Me, Leslie Stahl. I'll go first. I wanted to. Okay.
It's a subtle way to make people feel comfortable in questioning. You answer the question yourself, and then it gives them time to think.
What's your name? I'll go first. Hampton Young.
Yeah, you can.
There you go. Hey, nice to meet you. What's your name? I'll go first.
Will you have sex with me? My answer, yes.
Taco Bell what now? What was the thing you said?
I just wanted to make a dumb question. I was just thinking that, honestly, I think my favorite fast food item is the Taco Bell steak taco.
Oh, okay.
I think they're discontinuing. It's making me very upset.
That's awful.
I know. I'm in mourning.
Yeah.
No, I know. I
Good
had to
morning.
Break up with my girlfriend. I broke up with my family.
Whoa.
I quit my job.
Damn. Well, I hope the steak taco doesn't go away then.
No, it's going away, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but if it comes back, then you'll get all those people back in your life.
Yeah, I'm doing a letter writing campaign to Taco Bell right now.
Man, you important. Should tell Trump, the president.
Dave, tell we can't mention Trump every joke.
No, that's every joke. That's true. God, shit. I'm such a fucking hack. Dude, I know my favorite fast food item. It's the jalapeno poppers at Jack in the Box.
Oh, my God. Really?
Oh, yeah.
Hell they
yeah,
are dude. Good.
They're so good. Little ranch. Buttermilk house sauce, actually. That's what they call it.
House sauce.
Buttermilk house sauce. Hey, what's... wow, that sounds good to say.
You have jack off in
buttermilk
the box?
Buttermilk house sauce.
So let me get this straight. You jack off in a box.
No, I jack on the box.
That's just a West Coast thing, right? Like, they don't have...
Jacking on the box?
Yeah.
Yes. We jack on here on the West Coast.
Jack in the box, it's West Coast, right? Like, they don't have it on the East Coast.
They're slowly making their way east.
Okay.
Yeah, man. I think they made their way to, like, Kansas now. Yeah, dude. Jack? Jack's
love
working
that
on
like
it.
Like a virus that's spreading.
Yeah, like the fucking human race.
Come with it now. Dave's getting political.
the human race, they're like a virus. I don't know if you've ever noticed, human beings, they're like germs.
You, dude, have you ever gone to the top of the Empire State Building and looked down and just been like, look at all these sheep.
Look at all these sheep.
Look at all these fucking dude, ants.
My safe space is... My safe space is Hot Topic, dude. And when I go in there, I look at the rest of the mall and I go, look at all the sheeple outside of here.
Absolutely, dude. Yeah, I look out the fucking front window and I just point at people and I say, shit, piss, fuck, cunt, cocksucker, yeah, motherfucker. And I point at myself and I'm like, fart.
Yeah, I hug a Stewie Griffin dressed as Scarface t-shirt yeah, and I just look at the rest of the mall and go, look at all these germs, yeah, these sheeple.
Yeah, you wouldn't even know a Hello Kitty backpack if you saw one.
I do remember that sensation when you grow up and the first time you start to get like, you go up a skyscraper or something and you look down or you're on a plane and you're like, they are all ants. Like, you ever had that absolutely dumb, that dumb fucking childish
thought? I had a conversation with my college roommate looking out of our, we lived like the 15th floor of this apartment building in downtown LA and we could like see the 110 and we saw gridlock traffic and we were just like, man, we're never going to be a part of that fucking.
I think it's always funny to like look at like a photo of Earth and be like, look at all these people fucking. At any given point, you look at Earth,
dude, just tons of people
are fucking and sucking on that planet right now.
Dude, at this exact moment right now, how many people do you think are coming? And then I saw Amelie, and I was like, oh, everyone thinks this. That's like a whole part of Amelie.
Yeah, I never watched that.
Oh, you should, dude. It's super French.
I saw the poster. I got it.
Yeah, totally.
I saw the poster of Amelie.
The movie basically is a poster.
Yeah, I saw the poster of Amelie, and I got the whole movie. Yeah,
totally.
You want to blow your mind, watch Run Lola Run, dude.
Dude.
That's experimental film.
I made this movie called Run Amelie Run.
It's a girl running away from never having to come. Or, yeah.
It's just it's just a documentary about croissants. Hampton, you're recording an album.
Thank you. Why are you shouting at me?
I don't know, dude. Fucking like get on board with your own shit.
That's right. If you're in Chicago, guess what? I'm at the Lincoln Lodge.
I'm at the Lincoln Lodge. Who even cares?
We're not doing this bit again. August 31st and September 1st in Chicago. It's the Under the Gun Theater. And please come out, guys. Tickets are on sale. And I'm really hoping to get some people to come out. I actually heard that it might be a little bit of a slump. So
what might be a slump?
Like they say, the summer is kind of a low turnout, actually.
Oh.
Which is weird because I always thought summer was really like a good turnout.
Yeah,
when I started out in DC, it was always good. And then in LA, no one can ever tell because it's always summer.
It's always summer in Philadelphia. I love that show.
Hot riff.
Thanks, man.
It's always summer in Philadelphia. Yeah.
What?
And I'll be.
What's a riff about that?
My question exactly.
That's the name of my other podcast. What's a riff about that?
But I can't wait to record this album. And you know what, Dave? I'm gonna call it right here. Probably the last comedy thing I ever do.
Really? You're gonna quit?
Please come out.
Is that because of the steak taco?
It's because of the steak taco.
Yeah, man.
The fact
that
that's gone is like, I mean, it's a chapter of my life is now finished. Like if you were to write the book of my life.
And I will.
Yeah, and I know you're writing it. So let me.
Yeah. Booked and yunt.
You're off the project. You're already off the project.
You don't like the name? Aw, man.
We have fought over this title sucks. For months.
Fine.
Yeah.
I'll call it Book Taco.
First line of the book, I was born and I started remembering everything.
Yeah.
Start from there.
But it's written by me, so why would I say that?
I don't know. You're a good writer.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's a nice compliment.
You can imagine me. Yeah.
I'm Hampton. Imagine I'm Hampton.
Yeah,
go
really
to Chicago at some point.
Yeah, August 31st, September 1st. Both shows at 8 o'clock.
And since shows are a slump in the summer, you should buy your tickets. And
buy
help.
Tickets. Buy tickets for people you don't even know. Get them to come
buy
out.
Buy tickets and don't even go to it.
Yeah, I don't care.
I just want the money.
I just want the money, not the audio for the album recording. But yeah, this will be fun. I can't wait to get rid of material.
Stop saying that.
You think it's a negative. I think it's great.
I don't think it's a negative, but I think it sounds like a negative.
Oh, I don't hate it at all. I don't hate the material. I love it. But I'm like so excited to start. Like, I like to like shape an album or like an hour in a certain way. Oh, and then yeah. It's like when it's all gone, it's like, well, what's the new hour going to be? Like, oh, yeah. It's fun.
What is it going to be?
It's mostly about you.
Comedy's hard.
It's mostly about you being a piece of shit.
Oh, God. You take so many things personally from me lately. I'm just having fun and you're
no, like... No, Dave, I'm telling you that's what the album's going to be. Why are you asked?
Huh? I actually don't think I did ask.
Damn it. You're right.
Yeah, man. You piece of shit. Jesus Christ.
Wait,
man.
Let me crack open this
book. You know, someone wrote me and was like, I'm sorry Hampton's being so mean to you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think it was my mom.
It was probably my mom. Why would your mom?
Because she likes you more than me.
Oh, that makes sense.
My mom likes you more than me.
I am great.
I'm going to crack this.
Have fun
blue,
opening that
I'm trying
Gatorade.
To open a blue Gatorade without,
I'm trying to open a Gatorade
without spilling it all over your bed.
Yeah.
Dude, I drink the blue Gatorade to calm down, and I drink the red to amp up.
I drink the white Powerade to fucking...
Dude, somebody sent us a picture of them drinking white Powerade after a joke we did on a previous episode.
So cool.
I love our fans.
Yeah, they're so awesome. Thank you guys so much for sending shit in.
Oh, man.
I keep thinking about the Fat Birds in the Snow DVD cover. God, man, I love that so much.
Yeah, somebody sent us a Princess Diana Beanie Baby with Suicide Buddies written on it.
So funny.
Which I think we could make, market.
Absolutely.
If audience people
still, there are still Beanie Baby people.
Yeah, if you guys don't want a feelings t-shirt, feel free to wait for us to... Handmake Beanie Babies.
But why would you not want a Suicide Buddies feelings t-shirt?
Why would you not want to have to explain this to all of your loved ones?
Why would you not want a shirt that doesn't say the name of the podcast on it? That shirt's still up, dude. Teespring.com/suicidebuddies-feelings.
Nice.
Right?
Nice promo.
Fuck yeah, dude. We should get into this shit, man.
Yeah,
this
dude,
fucker,
you seem
dude.
To be doing a ton of research, so I would love to know what this is going to be. Who are we doing this week?
His name's Kevin Carter.
Kevin Costner?
It's Aaron Carter. imagine
House
if Kevin Costner fucked Aaron
House
Carter.
House of Carters?
Go. Yeah.
Aaron Carter? Aaron's party.
Dancing with Wolves, you know that dude? The guy who like danced with his four friends for Wolves?
I feel really bad, actually, about Aaron Carter.
About how you called me a piece of shit a minute ago,
yes,
you fucking
always,
dick.
Of course. But Aaron Carter, like, one time I was working on a show that was like a really bad sketch show that Shaq had for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And like, we just, out of nowhere, we're kind of like shitting on Aaron Carter. And then we like made it a sketch where we were like, what if we really got Aaron Carter? And like, because one of his music videos was How I Beat Shaq. It was Aaron Carter as a kid being like, and that's how I beat Shaq. And it was all this music video where he's like playing basketball against Shaq. And we're like, what if we got him back? And then Shaq's just like, you know, killing him on the court now. And then we got Aaron Carter and he was like so methed out. We were like, whoa. Oh, we feel terrible. Like, the whole bit was like, Aaron's like on Skid Row. And then he really was like,
whoa.
Like really fucked up.
More like scaring Carter. Wow, I really am just bad at comedy.
No, dude, you're the best.
Thanks, man.
You're really great. You should record an album, man.
I'm going to. I got the date at the Echo in...
August 31st and September 1st in Chicago?
In Chicago, yeah. Actually, they told me that the summer is great for ticket sales.
That's so funny. No, where the Echo?
At the Echo in LA in February. More details to come.
That's great, dude. That's a great venue.
We got some months.
That's
yeah.
So
oh man,
fun, man,
I'm so excited. It's like my favorite. It's like my favorite venue in
really?
LA. Oh yeah, dude. I've been going to see shows at the Echo. I saw the OCs open for Jay Retard right before he died.
You watched the OC in Laguna Beach?
Yeah, dude. I watched the OC at the Echo, and I was like, this show rules. I should do an album.
We've been having fun driving in the sun, driving down the 101.
So this guy's name is Kevin Carter, and yeah, I'll tell you about him.
That's a good intro.
Thanks.
All right,
dude.
We'll be back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Doesn't matter what they say, 'cause I'm gonna get my way if I don't wanna go.
Oh yeah!
It is funny how much of our culture is just based around trying to be awesome. I fucking hate it, man. Entourage, dude. This dude got famous, and then his friends, they all run around, and they try to fuck girls, dude. It's fucking crazy.
You know what I think the shift was? When we just couldn't call them ranch Doritos, we had to call them Cool Ranch.
Remember that period of time?
Cool? They're not cool.
When it was Cooler Ranch? It was Cooler Ranch.
Is that how you could put ice cubes in your ranch?
And nacho cheesier. And then they switched back, and they were like, why did we do that?
Yeah.
Did you ever get the Doritos was putting out, like, secret flavors for a while? There was one called, like, X13, and you were supposed to guess what the flavor was.
MS-13.
MS-13, yeah, totally.
All the Doritos are, like, tatted up.
yeah. It tasted like bullets. I don't know if you heard anything about MS-13, but
they're
fucking murderers,
dude. No, I didn't know they did that,
dude. Yeah, and it was...
Secret flavors?
Yeah. X13 was the one I got, and it was just cheeseburger. It was definitely a cheeseburger. It was terrible, yeah.
Yeah. Dude, they just discontinued their only vegan flavor, Doritos.
Really?
Which was, I think it was...
Was it called, like, fucking cowardice?
I think it's called sweet chili. Chili, and it was their only vegan flavor, and they got rid of it for the new Blaze. This is the fucking problem, dude. Come with it now. Oh, these Doritos are too cool.
I love that it's...
Motherfuckers in the government.
I love flavors that are not flavors. Like Blaze. Like, I was
like
in
white
the
Powerade.
Fucking grocery store the other day, and there was a deodorant with a scent, and the scent was Extreme Blast. And I was like, what does that smell like?
One time I used a shampoo that was called Scorpion.
Yeah, what the fuck, dude? Yeah. My soap flavor is fuck you.
Wow, you really smell like fuck you.
Smells good, dude. Smells like fucking new car smell.
Wolf.
I like the idea of scrubbing yourself with something that smells like a new car.
Eagle's taint.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah! Bitch, you better fuck me.
I don't know if you knew this, but eagles have big balls.
I'm not doing it.
And falcons have big balls.
I refuse.
All right, Kevin Carter. So, okay, Kevin Carter was a photojournalist from South Africa, and the thing he's most famous for is this photo called The Vulture and the Little Girl. Do you remember
this? Oh, my God,
this?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, no, I want to paint a picture of without...
Yeah, so he took this photo, and I'll talk about it at length.
Use 1,000 words. You know, pictures worth 1,000 words.
Oh, okay, I will use
only
exactly 1,000 words.
Not any
more, no less.
It's a famous photo, and it's very tragic.
Yeah, I mean, like... ramping up to apartheid ending, there was all sorts of civil war in South Africa, and it was bleeding into the surrounding countries. And Sudan, as a result, was like just decimated by famine. And so, because like the revolutions were pouring over into there, so we went into Sudan to cover the famine. And he came across this little girl who was like trying to get to a UN feeding center and was just so fucking famine stricken that couldn't move. And so the photo is of her like crouched on the ground with her head and torso between her legs and literally a vulture waiting behind her.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Austin,
it's so
seemingly
grim.
Waiting for her to die, to eat her.
And it's truly one of those photos that I think drew up a lot of controversy because people were like, is this like exploitive in the
right
sense of like you see, you know, like
why didn't you help
you're
the
right
girl?
There. Yeah,
what's
yeah.
fucked up is that he did help the girl.
Yeah,
he just
no,
waited.
And clearly he did. And, you know, and it's the
and
framing
she lived
of the photo
for like 15 more years.
And it's more like he's trying to. Oh my God. That's so not that very long.
It's not that very long.
And then, but yeah, it's he's using kind of art in kind of a journalistic way. You know, it's weird because it crosses that line.
Right.
Where people are like, what is the message you're trying to make with this photo sort of thing? You
know? Well, that's like a really good point, man. And it has a lot to do with his suicide. It really does.
Really?
So, yeah, he was born September 13th, 1960. And it was like, I believe the day the ANC was banned from South Africa or something. ANC, the African National Congress, which ended up having, it was like Nelson Mandela's group.
Right, yeah, yeah.
They were, you know, what overthrew apartheid or got rid of apartheid. So born 1960, then when he was 33 years old, July 27th, 1994, he grew up in this white suburban neighborhood in apartheid South Africa called Parkmore.
Oh, wow.
And so in July of 1994, he drove back to his neighborhood in his red truck up to this river that he used to play in and took a garden hose and, you know, attached it from his exhaust pipe, into his the cab of his truck, closed the windows.
Oh, wow.
And died.
Wow. First time I saw that was in that movie, The Client.
Oh, yeah.
The guy tries to kill himself. And I was like, that is brilliant.
Dude,
like,
right.
I was like, that is easily the easiest way to kill yourself.
Right.
You just need a hose.
Yes, totally. I remember the first time I heard of this type of suicide, I was like, wait, you can just do that? You don't have to like buy a gun or pills. Or...
I know. Every time someone's like, oh, I just, when we were talking to Steve Agee and we were like, how would you kill yourself? And he was like, a gun. I was like, that's always so violent. Like, you know, you just need a hose.
Yeah. Yeah, you can buy a hose at Home Depot.
I'm not advocating.
First of all, I hate what I just said. I'm literally saying you can just buy a hose, dude. So easy, dude.
It's so easy.
Don't do it. Whoever you are who heard that and got excited, don't fucking do it.
I'll one
love
up you.
You.
Here's the easiest way.
Did you hear me say we love you? We love you.
Here's the easiest way to kill yourself. Just hold your breath, dude.
Yeah.
Fucking hold your breath. Die.
Dude, I honestly, thank you.
Absolute easiest way.
Yeah. Okay, no, here's the... No, honestly, all right. No, I see where we're going with
this. Close your nose.
The absolute easiest way to commit suicide is to just wait until eventually you die of old age.
Dude, that's the sickest suicide. Honestly, people are like looking at an old man and be like, wow, he was so fucked up.
Wow, dude. Gone too soon.
Easiest way to kill yourself, slow your heart down until it stops.
Yeah, dude. Just like try to engage in loving relationships throughout your life. Know that you are loved, and eventually you're going to die anyway. So fucking, who cares, dude?
That might be the most helpful advice.
Yeah, seriously. Like, if you're thinking about suicide,
just
you
remember,
will die.
Yeah, just remember.
Just so you know, you're going to die. So you don't have to do it yourself.
Wow,
that could be like extreme comfort for an incredibly depressed person.
Sometimes I did consider that. I'm just like, what am I doing? I'm going to just die.
I got all these emails to answer. Why am I doing this first?
Well, getting back to Aaron Carter,
and
House of Carters, apartheid was basically like just still like civil rights that had not caught up yet. Like it was like literally South Africa was going through what America had gone through.
Right.
But kind of on a worse scale.
Yeah, because it was modern day. It was modern day institutionalized racism, which is interesting. Like, it almost makes sense to me that apartheid was the way it was up to the 90s, because in order for institutionalized racism to last that long, mm-hmm. in a world that had turned its back on it and was trying to integrate, is to make it law.
Yeah.
And it was like extreme law. Like, black people had to carry passbooks. I mean, most people listening know this.
Yeah.
Actually, Kevin Carter said that when he said in some interviews, when he was a kid in this white suburban apartheid accepting neighborhood, it was an English neighborhood. His parents were English immigrants and they were Catholics. So they weren't Afrikaners.
Wow.
And the country was run by white Afrikaners, which were Dutch white people who had taken over South Africa.
It's so weird the way they talk. It's still weird. Dutch. Yeah. It's very
Blick. He's Blick. That's how it sounds. Very weird.
He's a Blick. He's a Blick gay.
Yeah, it sounds sort of Australian, but like a little even more thin.
I tried to make a joke at one point that it's like they're the perfect intersection between England and Australia. It's that weird like that intersection of language. You know? Yeah.
We don't We don't even try to open our mouth. That's not even how it
well,
sounds.
Well, Elon Musk, he's like, you know, everyone here is a robot, right? And I want to, everyone in the audience that I'm talking to right now is a robot. And I want to send all of you robots into space with the car. I want all of the robots to have cars in space.
I only eat fruit.
I only eat fruit. That's why people hate him.
So he grew up in this white neighborhood called Parkmore that was an English neighborhood. His parents were English, and they would literally see like black people trying to live in their neighborhood illegally, and they wouldn't report them. But then they would see the cops walk up to these black people and be like, show me your passbook.
Wow.
And they wouldn't have a passbook for the neighborhood, and then we'd see them get arrested. And
damn, dude, this was Chappie.
Wow.
This was District 9, dude?
Yeah. Yeah, they were all bugs.
Do you think those movies are about racism?
Bronx. Yeah, watch the movie. It's like, Jesus Christ. Just make a movie about apartheid.
You don't have to be like, black people are like bugs.
Yeah, like, what the fuck?
That's the only way I can relate.
Prawns. They're all prawns. So
still a good movie, though.
Kevin Carter apparently loved his parents, but he talked about it in an interview how he flipped out on his parents once when he was a kid.
Wow.
And was like, why didn't you say anything to the cops? Why are we sitting here doing nothing? Yeah. We should have at least yelled at the fucking cops.
Wow. Quit it now.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, honestly, he sounds cool. That's
dude, this
that's
guy
awesome.
Was a badass. The first thing, so when he was a teenager, he got really into riding motorcycles and told everyone he wanted to be a race car driver. That was
cool.
He was just a dude who was into badass shit, basically.
Nice. That's a lot of photographers, honestly.
Right, yeah.
They tend to be like very talented in like multiple fields, and then they kind of focus then on photography.
Yeah,
because
it's a crazy lifestyle. You're like, I'm just gonna go into the most fucked up places with my camera and stand there with them and be like, no, just do it.
Yeah.
Just do it. Just shoot each other. Just do it.
And it's like a lot of like training, technical, you know, like
hiding,
aspects and
running from cops. Totally. Like,
yeah. It's just,
So, that's what he did as a teenager. He went to college to become a pharmacist and then dropped out because of bad grades.
Okay.
And then he was drafted into the army and he didn't want to go.
Drafted?
Yeah. He didn't want to fight like in the army. So he joined the Air Force. And so then while he was in the Air Force, one time in the mess hall, there was a black waiter that like most of the people in the Air Force, most of the white people in South Africa were Afrikaners. And they just, their culture was they hated black people. They liked apartheid. So, yeah. Well, not all of them probably, but yeah.
It was significant.
Right. So, they were like fucking with a black waiter. And apparently this like teenager, he stands up and he's like, hey, leave that guy alone. And then all of the white Afrikaners there just beat the shit out of him.
Holy
in this,
shit.
Yeah, just beat the shit out of him. So, he.
Right then and there?
Yeah.
Holy fuck.
And no one cared. Like, they were like, fuck. And they were calling him, I'm not going to say the word, but they were calling him things. You know what I mean?
Like, nerd.
Yeah.
Spaz.
Like, awesome. like you're cool.
Blaze.
We love you. Yeah.
X13.
Yeah. MS-13.
All the cool flavors.
Donald Trump.
God damn. You MS-13 lover?
So after that, he went AWOL from the military. Literally.
Tight, dude.
Yeah.
This guy is fucking,
he's fucking
sick.
So he goes AWOL from the military.
I love this guy.
Rides a motorcycle to a city called Durban.
Hell
starts
yeah.
Calling himself David.
Popped
and tries
a wheelie
to,
the whole way.
Yeah, exactly. Literally changes his name to David and tries to become a radio DJ.
Fuck yes!
Yeah.
Howard Stern is this guy?
Actually, it was me, so.
You were waiting on that.
On David,
that's
dude.
So fucking cool, man.
Yeah, and apparently that was, like, too hard to do to just become a radio DJ.
Yeah.
So he was like, fuck, all right, I'll just go back and serve the rest of my time in the military so that doesn't hang over me the rest of my life.
You can just go back?
Yeah.
You don't have to go to, like, military prison for a bit?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the details on that.
Wow, they must have been loose.
Yeah. I think they were like, you're white.
Oh, that being a DJ didn't work out. Oh, yes, being a DJ didn't work out.
Yeah, you're on the radio.
Right. Well, at least you know a black fella. At least you know a black fella. I guess you can come back.
Yeah, you know, black. So.
Everything all white? All right.
I think that's probably, they were like, hey, fuck you, but you're white.
I would imagine that was certain.
I kind of imagine. It's pretty interesting also in this time when Nelson Mandela like came back and, you know, out of prison, gets elected. The culture of white people were very terrified that it was like going to be like reverse. Like, oh shit, all the bad shit we've been doing for forever is now going to happen to us. And it's so funny that they never even thought of that.
Yeah.
For decades. They just were that, oh, now we should be terrified. Oh, I just realized how shitty I've been.
Dude, I know. Isn't that insane?
Yeah.
Someone's saying, I love, man, have you ever read any of the transcripts of work, like Nazis apologizing?
Oh, my God.
It's like, what the fuck, man?
I'm sorry.
You know, I didn't really think about it. Everyone was just doing it.
I was being weird. God. I just had like a weird, you know, time there.
I've been thinking about it, and Jews are people, and I'm just so, I'm so sad.
Boy, okay. I was wrong.
Oh, wow. Egg on my face.
Egg on my face.
Whoopsie. I am so sorry. I murdered those people. Millions. Wow. Too many. Anyway, so while he was back in the military, at one point in 1983, he was standing guard in Pretoria at some fort or citadel or whatever, and there was like a militant side of the ANC that basically started carrying out terrorist acts against the National Party, which was the party that ruled South Africa, the white Afrikaner party. Yeah.
This is going to happen. This sort of oppressive system. You're going to get like homeland terrorism. Basically.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a negative connotation to that word terror, but they were freedom fighters who were attacking. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to be a Che Guevara tweet here or anything, but
right.
They're very similar.
He just like watched the Church Street bombing happen, and it made him decide to get into journalism. Wow. That's the like the very easy version of the story. So the funny thing is that after that, he like the first job he gets is as a sports photographer.
Cool.
Right after he's like, I saw this bombing, I want to be a photographer, and then he gets into sports.
Well, I think the thing is also I believe sports is generally something that's
easier to get into.
Like when they give you assignments, it's like, well, this is more just fun.
Right.
Go cover fun.
Right.
You know, this isn't like we need the serious news, you know.
Yeah, so pretty quickly he moved from that into to the Johannesburg Star, which is their big newspaper, and started covering apartheid.
Whoa. Big level up.
Yeah.
So I guess he really proved himself and he's doing
I mean,
work.
If you look through this guy's history, I mean, he won a Pulitzer for that vulture photo.
Yeah.
And he like, so that was in 1984, I believe, he moved to the Johannesburg Star, and then he died in 1997. So in the span, 1994. So in the span of 10 years, he won a Pulitzer.
Wow.
Once he joined the Johannesburg Star, the revolution in South Africa was ramping up hardcore. And then by 1990, there's civil war literally between different factions of the people revolting, of the black people revolting against apartheid.
Yeah.
Also,
holy
so
shit.
Black people are killing each other over disagreements about the revolution.
Yeah.
And they're also all trying to end apartheid. I mean, there's just murder and death and famine everywhere while there's institutionalized racism. So he joins... he becomes a photojournalist at the Johannesburg Star and starts covering all of this, is immediately in the fray and is immediately the best at it. The problem was that it was dangerous as all fuck. Like one of the things that he covered, he was one of the first people to cover a thing called necklacing, which I had to look up as a result of this, which hadn't even heard of.
Very
necklacing
scared.
Is when you fill a truck tire with gasoline and then you slide it around a person's body and set it on fire and watch them burn to death.
So they have to be like proportionally where the tire would cinch around their body.
Well, it can't be. Yeah. So it doesn't work on fat people.
It has to be a fat person or just fat enough. Like Winnie the Pooh.
Well, there are sizes of tires.
Well, imagine you're super thin and the tire just goes right.
That's true. Well, that's why you should. Everybody should be skinny.
Guys, I don't mean to body shame, but you don't want to get necklace.
Guys, you don't want to be necklace. Now, wait. Actually, they probably put it around their neck. I get it now. Necklacing.
No, they squeeze it around your arms.
Okay.
Yeah.
Damn, that's fucking awful, man.
Dude. Yeah, so, like, keep in mind...
You know, apartheid was bad, but at least we got Trevor Noah out of it.
Thank you.
That's what I always say.
You know what? That's what the whole thesis statement of this entire thing was.
At least we got the comedy stylings of Trevor Noah.
God, he's funny. Fuck. Love him.
He's not bad, but you know.
No, he's not that bad. Not that great. So I think, like, when we're talking about him, it's good to remember that this entire time, this entire history you're hearing of him, every day he's watching people get brutally fucking murdered.
Oh my God.
In front of each other, like warring.
It's traumatizing.
A lot of these people who should be on the same side too, just fucking killing each other.
God.
In brutal, awful ways.
This is so funny because I was just trying to watch a documentary the other day about war journalism. Like, I find it so fucking interesting. And it really was like, you know, Edward R. Murrow and people like, you know, you could die. And a lot of war journalists, like, your crew dies.
Yeah.
It's kind of being asked, are you comfortable possibly dying?
Yes.
You know,
and like, watching your friends die.
And then, like, sure enough, like, you know, every news team, like, will lose, like, a couple members.
Man,
you know,
it's so
in a conflict.
It's so crazy that you bring that up because he, like, okay, by 1990, like I said, there was civil war between these revolutionary parties. And it became really, really dangerous for solo photojournalists to go document these battles.
Yeah.
So he linked up with three other photojournalists.
Migos?
That were, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so that was the Beatles.
They took their own photos.
Some of them worked at the Weekly Mail, which was like, at that point, now it's called Mail and Guardian. This guy, Kevin Carter, was one of the people that started the political photojournalism department at the Weekly Mail.
Wow.
Yeah, this guy's amazing. So he and a friend from there and then a couple freelance photojournalists linked up, and the four of them, their names were Kevin Carter, Ken Oosterbrook, Kevin Marinovich, and Joao Silva. And they ran around together photographing these atrocities and the war. They became so good and so lauded. Their photos were so popular and in the Weekly Mail so much and in other publications so much that people started calling them the Bang Bang Club.
Huh.
Yeah, that's the nickname
that
for their...
That should be the fucking movie, dude.
No shit.
Call it the Bang Bang Club.
There is a movie,
about
him.
Really?
And it's like, I think it's called The Death of Kevin Carter.
Oh, okay.
And then something, The Bang Bang Club. So you're not wrong,
okay,
dude.
I'm not wrong. So you're saying I'm not... wrong.
Your note.
Just want to mark it down.
No, you're so right. Yeah. No. I know.
Right,
I know this feeling.
Let's write this down.
Hampton, I know how good that feels. I support.
I was thinking the other day. I don't know if it's too general, but I was like white guys saying, "You're not wrong."
Yeah,
is our way of saying you're right.
Yes, right.
Like, we can't just say you're right. We go, "You're not wrong."
Yeah, you might as well say I'm more right. You're not wrong, but I want to be the one who's right. Yeah. Okay, so the Bang Bang Club is getting really popular. Their photos are everywhere. And they get really into smoking weed.
Now I like them even more.
Yeah. So they're like pot-smoking renegade photojournalists.
Fuck yeah. Yeah, you would, man.
Who are, like watching murder and death all the time. Yeah, I read that, and I was like, yeah, that makes sense. That's great. What's wrong with weed? And then the very next thing is they started smoking this thing that people in South Africa called the white pipe, which is not crack. It's not cocaine, and it's not uppers. It's the white pipe is weed mixed with a tranquilizer called Mandrax. That apparently, when you smoke it, what it does is the Mandrax hits you first, so you get, like, super fucking down or stoned really hard for, like, half an hour or an hour, and then you coast down in your weed high for a while. And they got really into that.
It's like sipping lean. Like, they just want to get, like, completely, like,
just leave this world.
Yeah, knocked out. I mean, it sounds like what you're talking about, like, he's really experiencing a lot of trauma.
Yes.
Seeing a lot of trauma, experiencing it, and also trying to like self-medicate and get himself like, you know, stable.
Right. Right. He said when he first photographed necklacing.
Oh my God.
He was like, he said in an interview that he was totally rocked by it and disgusted by what he saw and sort of disgusted with himself that he was there watching it. But then the photos were released and the way that people reacted to it, mm-hmm. it felt like people were sort of rallying behind it. And yeah. that was the moment that made him realize maybe he's doing good for the world. Exposing atrocity.
I actually get like really weirdly sentimental or like emotional about like journalism because it's so important to to like just have a functioning democracy or country. You have to be very informed. But like, you know, you can look at the Vietnam War as kind of a turning point where it's like we started showing the atrocities kind of happening and soldiers, caskets coming back, you know, Dude. In boxes and shit. And it changed the public discourse because that helps people actually have to face like the brutality. Yeah. That's the thing is like you can talk a bunch about like, well, we need to do this measure. We need to do that. You know, this is just the way it is with war, you know, or like we have to take right. over this country or do these things. But it's like if you're actually faced with the actual brutal images of people dying and stuff, it makes you like have to.
It forces you to humanity. Care. Yeah, right.
You have to like either become human or become a monster. And, you know, most people would rather choose human.
Right.
Except for Frankenstein. Anyway. Wow. Except for Boo Berry.
So, okay, then we get to 1993. And this is a year before he died. 1993, he goes to Sudan. He takes that photo of the little girl with the vulture behind her. And, okay, so the thing with the photo is, he was just sort of walking around trying to document this famine. He comes across this girl who's trying to get to this feeding center, and he just sees her. And so he kneels down to take a photo of her, and while he's kneeling down taking a photo of her, a vulture landed.
Whoa.
And he's like, oh, shit.
Oh my
and so
God.
Apparently he sat there, and this is the part that I think people buck on, that are like, is it okay that he did this?
Right.
He apparently sat there for 20 minutes watching this girl hunched over, unable to move, hoping the vulture would spread its wings so he could get, trying to get the artful photo. And that's funny, like, you read interviews with his friends and other photojournalists at the time, they're just like,
That's the cum shot. Come
exactly.
on. Give me the money shot.
But that's the thing.
Come on, spread the wings.
What's weird about that is like, sure, yes, that sucks that someone is like trying to get an artful shot. But then if you think about it, from the standpoint of the power of a photo and how the more powerful of a photo, the more it affects
Absolutely.
People who see it.
Absolutely.
There are these interviews with his friends after he died about people who criticized him who were like, no, this is the job, man.
Also,
you try to frame up. Mm-hmm. I wish I remember the name of the dude. It was one of the guys in the Bang Bang Club who was like, literally in this interview saying, yeah, it's fucked up, man. You see a car crash, and then you try to frame up the body with the car, with the blood, and try to get the right combination of angles and colors. Because the thing is, people are subconsciously affected by the artfulness of a photo, and the artfulness makes them care about the atrocity more. And it's just like, shit.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like, that's his job, but also like, he has been doing this for a while. So, like, watching atrocities and stuff, it's like, trust that this guy kind of knows what he's doing at this point. You know, it's like,
well, in this photo, like,
been desensitized surely through all the things he's seen. So, at this point, it's like, he's trying to, like, tragedy is not new to him, and he's trying to, like, bring light to it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like you might have that reaction as somebody who's never been faced with this stuff before.
But it's not that simple.
But it takes
Nothing's
somebody
ever
who's
that
done
simple.
That. Yeah, it takes somebody who's been through all that shit to make that kind of photo.
Right.
You know? It took all that shit to get him there, basically.
And then he did help the girl, and it's funny, like, they found the girl's father at some, like, in the 2000 teens, and the guy was like, basically said, I'm glad he took the photo. She went on to live until 2007 when she died of, quote, fevers.
Okay.
Also, that was a boy. That was my son.
Is that ever real?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. The fucking smoking gun there. Yeah. Dude. Bury the lead.
Totally.
Holy shit.
So, okay. He at this point, in order to go to the Sudan to photograph the famine, he had to take time off from the Weekly Mail, who was his boss at the point. So he went freelance, and those photos were freelance. He didn't have to give them to the Weekly Mail. Oh. And the New York Times ended up buying that photo. And apparently it was like one of the most responded to photos they ever posted. Mm. People calling and writing letters asking how the girl is doing, what happened to her and things like that. He immediately became famous amongst journalists for the photo, and all his friends were complimenting him on it, right? Mm. So he quits the Weekly Mail. He goes freelance. He's freelance for a while, and then eventually signs with Reuters for a weekly stipend. He basically has a first look deal with them.
Yeah, he's like doing really well, and now he can freelance. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
But they pay him like $2,000 a week, so they get to pick out of the photos first, right? Mm. So then in March of 1994, it's so weird, man. Like, this guy's already had a crazy life, right?
Yeah.
And then his life multiplies in insanity like a hundredfold. So, like, from March to April of 1994, the amount of things that happened to him, I can't even imagine what this would do to a person's brain. So, March 11th, 1994. He's like in the middle of a firefight between policemen and some right wingers. The policemen win the firefight, and the people they don't kill, they just like stand them up and fucking execute them right in front of this dude.
Oh,
he's
God.
Like feet from them, and they don't kill him because he's a journalist. Oh, they just fucking shoot these guys right in front of him.
Holy shit.
And it destroys his brain. He just like can't
That's
handle it, and he
awful.
Starts smoking the white pipe all the time.
Oh, my God.
Then
that really does sound like sucking dick.
That's March 11th, 1994. April 12th, 1994. He finds out he's winning a Pulitzer. The New York Times calls him almost exactly a month later.
So huge down, big up.
Yeah. New York Times calls him, tells him you're winning a Pulitzer.
Oh my
God. And then like a few days after that, Ken Oosterbrook, his best friend in the world, gets killed.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
This all happens in like a month and a half. Yeah. He's like, for some reason, Kevin... I keep wanting to say Ken because his friend's name is Ken, but right. Kevin. Kevin Carter. He for some reason couldn't go on this trip to whatever fight this was.
Oh, man.
And Ken gets shot. And in an interview, Kevin told his friends, quote, "I should have taken the bullet."
Oh, no.
Yeah, man. So he's like fucked up at this point.
Yeah, at that point, he's really... self-loathing.
And so like, yeah, sure, he watched some people die. His best friend dies. He finds out he's winning a Pulitzer. And then when he wins the Pulitzer, this photo is brought back into the public eye. And then, you know, it's being talked about as the best photo ever taken.
Gotcha.
So all these photojournalists that are not tied to him just start talking shit. The entire South African journalist community is calling it a fluke that he won a Pulitzer. Literally the St. Petersburg...
Wow.
Is it the St. Petersburg Times? Yeah. The St. Petersburg Times out of Florida called him another vulture for...
Fuck you.
Yeah, fuck you.
Fuck you, Florida.
Yeah.
Fuck you. Shut the fuck
what
up.
What have you done, St. Petersburg?
Except for steal your name from Russia.
Dude. I drove me fucking insane when I read that.
So wait, you wrote and read it? No, just...
I wrote it, dude.
Shut
yeah,
up.
I'm in Florida
I'm
right now.
God.
So, yeah, his friend dies. He watches people get executed, starts doing more drugs. I forget where he was. He was somewhere in South Africa covering something, and he crashed his car into a suburban house and ended up in jail for 10 hours.
Whoa! Only 10 hours?
Yeah.
Again, that's really, at least you know what a black fella. Oh, we'd have to shoot you on the street just to look at you. No, drive through the house.
Where's
drive
your Facebook?
Through.
Where's your Facebook? Oh, I'm just kidding. Get out of here.
No, feel free to back up through the kitchen. Come on, we'll get you to jail.
So that happens, and his
Jesus Christ.
His boss at Reuters is super pissed at him for doing that. One, because it makes them look bad, but two, because his photos from the day are at the jail. So they have to drive to this town, to the jail, to get the photos that are supposed to go in the paper the next day. And then his girlfriend, who he's been dating for a year, leaves him because she's like, you do too many drugs. Also, he has a 6-year-old daughter out of wedlock at this point.
Oh.
Because he never got married and he just like fucked a bunch of people.
Sure.
And he's
Indiana Jones.
But he also apparently was crazy about his daughter. Like when he watched the people get murdered, people get executed, one of the things he told his friends was like, yeah, when it happened, all I wanted to do was hug my daughter. It was horrifying.
Oh my Lord.
Oh no, that was about the That was about when he took the photo in Sudan. I like was just looking at this little girl and I just wanted to hug my daughter.
Oh my God.
Okay, so all of that happens in the span of a month and a half. He goes to New York to receive his Pulitzer. And so he's at these like black tie, white tie galas with everyone kissing his ass, telling him he's the best thing to happen to photojournalism. People walking up to him in restaurants, asking him for his autograph, women flocking to him and trying to fuck him. And meanwhile, he's winning this award for having been in the middle of like genocide over racism in the government. And they're just like, you're great.
Yeah, yeah.
So when he killed himself.
Isn't it great? Apartheid's so great. The way you cover all that genocide, you're so cool.
I want to suck your dick. And he's like, God damn it. I'm sure, man, I would imagine at least a couple times he just looked someone right in the eyes and was like, I watch 5 people get murdered. And they're like, backing into the bushes. Like, that's his life at this current moment.
Wow.
When he committed suicide, there were a bunch of people, and we talk about this phenomenon on this podcast a lot. There were a bunch of people that were like, yeah, he couldn't handle the fame. It's like, oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's not reductive at all. He was totally fine, and then he got famous, and he was like, fuck this.
Oh, I see. He got those stars in his eyes. Suddenly, he was a baby.
Dude.
That's fucking hysterical that people would think that. I mean, like, this guy sounds like he's had, like, I don't know. It's also
maybe the most overwhelming life possible.
You know what's also interesting is, like, we've talked about people who have suffered, like, incredible trauma or experienced or been around great trauma, but he's somebody who actually threw himself into the trauma.
Yeah.
He, from an early age, is engaging with this and wants to confront it head on.
Right.
So, I don't know. I mean, but at a certain point, it's like, if you're destroying yourself through drugs and through self-hate and not, you know, engaging in healthy relationships, it's going to just blow up in your face.
Right. It's like, the thing he chose was difficult to manage, but then the things he chose to manage it made it worse over time.
It's a noble thing to do, but it's like, if the way you're dealing with it is to, like, you know, kill yourself, basically.
Right.
What are you going to do?
So July 27th, 1994, he apparently had like a pretty calm day. He drove to the Weekly Mail to drop off photos, and then he went to his best friend Ken's widow's house and just like vented to her about how he was feeling, how sad he was.
Wow.
And she is like just 3 months deep into mourning for her husband. Then he drives to that river in Parkmore and commits suicide. And he left a note in his car. And I'm so pissed. I tried forever to find the note. I could only find excerpts.
That's fine.
But here's what I found of the suicide note. It says, I'm really, really sorry. The pain of life overrides the joy to the point that joy does not exist. Depressed, without phone, money for rent, money for child support, money for debts, money, with 3 exclamation points. I'm haunted by the vivid memories of killings and corpses and anger and pain, of starving or wounded children, of trigger-happy madmen, often police, of killer executioners. I have gone to join Ken if I am that lucky.
Wow.
Yeah.
Aww.
I know,
that's
man.
So sad.
Like, such a valiant person.
Bad, man.
And
wow.
It just got to him.
I don't know, dude. I like Sam Kinison's take on Africa. You know? Why don't you move to where the food is, you dumb jerks? Get out of there. Just go to where there's a burger, you piece of fucking shit.
What a fuck that guy.
Man, dude, that was amazing. I mean, any thoughts? I mean, I feel like we kind of covered it.
Yeah, we covered it, man. It's a... it's just tragic. I mean, it's weird because it's similar to other stories we've told in that, like, no matter what, any suicide story involves depression and anxiety always. But this, the way that this story is different is that, like, he just experienced so much outside pressure, and the fact that he put himself through it, like, almost no human being would put themselves through that much anguish.
Yeah.
But he, like, seems like he felt like it was his calling, like he had to.
Well, I feel like for people, you know, who listen to us and sometimes they write, and I, you know, a common thing is dealing with PTSD and dealing with, like, trauma and, like, experiencing, like, horrific events sort of thing. And, like, something is that's really necessary is you just have to take the time to deal with it.
You have to take care of yourself. You know, I was talking to someone the other day about they're married to someone who is big with the DSA and big in activism in LA. And they were saying that their husband is like has to take months long breaks from activism to sort of like relieve stress and calm down and feel okay. And whenever they do that, there's a certain amount of the activist community that's like, oh, he's taking a break. He doesn't care. But here's the thing that made me think, like, first of all, good on him for knowing that he has to stay mentally healthy in order to do this.
It's because he cares.
It's because he cares. Yeah. He'll kill himself if the stress never ends.
Yeah,
that's what will happen. And I hope that we – I mean, that's the reason you have – that you work with people – that way, like, if you need to take a month break because this shit is driving you crazy, first of all, you're not going to be very good at helping people if you're going crazy yourself. And secondly, you have these people around you to sort of pick up the torch while you're gone, and then you come back and they can take a break. And we could all help each other, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I hope that we can change the culture around that and say to each other, like, yes, you do need a break. We'll take care of it. You come back. You tag me out. In whatever you're doing.
Dave, I need a break from the podcast.
Okay, great.
I got to go record an album in Chicago, August 31st and September 1st.
Best you just run out the door. There's a U-shaped hole in the wall.
Why does it look like the Kool-Aid man?
Weird. Hampton's shaped weird.
Well, dude, that was fantastic.
Thanks, man. That was fun.
I love that story. Guys, thanks for listening. We really appreciate you. You guys are the best fans.
Yeah, you're so good, man. And also, thank you all who have signed up for the Patreon. I hope you continue to sign up. Patreon.com/suicidebuddies.
Yeah, good. I want to actually, I realize we maybe don't explain the Patreon. We do, like, basically, almost like it's like fantasy football when we do the Patreon, because we like usually talk about like some sort of fictional suicide, and it gives us more chance to just have a looser, more fun.
It's funny. Anthony and I just realized, I don't think we even say on the regular podcast that we do bonus episodes, but yeah, we do like 30 minute to an hour long bonus episodes twice a month, at least, sometimes more. And also we make like, stupid ringtones that sound like radio shit.
I'm trying to put one up.
Yeah.
New. And Dave actually just put up a new tier of a Patreon subscriber for the Saudi princes. And check out what he wrote. It's really funny. So just check out patreon.com/suicidebuddies. And
yeah, we don't have a bonus episode this week, but we have a bonus episode coming out next week. And some more shit also. Cool.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah, see you next time.
Appreciate it.
Ooh, that was an episode of Suicide Buddies. Ooh, it is rough. I know we got a little deep. We got a little dank. We got a little bit of dark. And we just want you to know, Dave and I, that we don't really take this that lightly. We realize that a lot of people are struggling out there. And we want you to know that if you are dealing with these dark thoughts right now, it would be great if you could call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It's at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. And they have the resources to help you deal with this in a little bit more of a medically professional way. So we would appreciate that. And we're happy that you're with us. Thanks for listening.